Okay, welcome everyone. This is the second broadcast of Don't Let It Go Unheard. And this week we are not unheard, apparently. You can all hear me, which is excellent. I'm Amy Peekoff, and as I talked about last week, the purpose of this webcast is to talk about politics and politics from an objectivist perspective. So if you don't mind, we're just going to go ahead and jump right in. I will tell you one thing of a technical nature. There is a little icon in your dock, I guess you would call it, and it allows you to raise your hand. I saw someone doing it already. Just to be clear, if your hand is unraised, as it appears to me, you will see a little green up arrow in the little raise hand icon. It's basically telling you that if you click on that, you will be raising your hand. And then if your hand is up, as it appears to me, what you'll see is a little hand with a red down arrow, and that tells you that if you click on it, you will be taking your hand down. I think there's been some confusion in the past with people who have been on the webcast last week and in a practice session as to when your hand is raised and when it's not. So hopefully that helps make it clear. Let's go ahead and get started. The first story that I want to talk about is one that was sent in by Carl S., who unfortunately actually can't be with us this evening, but I'm happy that he sent us in the story. It's actually not a very new story. It's from November 2010. It appeared on WSB-TV, and it's been passed around on Facebook this week, perhaps because of the events in the Middle East. The headline is Mosque Makeovers with Your Tax Dollars. And it's actually a video from WSB-TV that you can watch. And in the video, the newscaster talks about the fact that there are 770 million of your tax dollars that have been spent to save mosques in Egypt because they were being damaged due to inoperable sewage systems in Egypt. So we apparently paid for the sewage system to be repaired. And in the news story, they also talk about the fact that there are other monies that have gone to restore and preserve mosques in other countries as well. The other thing that they talked about was the fact that in Egypt itself, your tax dollars have been paying for internet service at the mosques as well. So I'm sure everyone's very thrilled to have their tax dollars going to such a noble cause. The newscaster, I guess he's just a local newscaster, he tried to talk to someone at the State Department and get them to respond to, you know, the criticism that's coming about this. And State Department has said a couple things. They said, first of all, this is part of our campaign to win the hearts and minds of Muslims. A bunch of garbage, of course. But then they did respond and say that they would look at, quote, slowing the growth of foreign aid, end quote. So that's always reassuring. They're going to slow the growth. I mean, you know, of course, the presumption is that we're going to give foreign aid. The only question is how much we're going to give. And hey, if we're for slowing the growth of foreign aid, boy, we're really for cutting the budget there. So basically, here we are. We're pumping our money, which we don't even have. Our budget's going to hell. We're pumping our money in to preserve the infrastructure of organized Islam in places like Egypt. And what are these mosques? These mosques are, as many commentators have stated, they are the headquarters of the consistent practitioners of Islam. You know, why do we want to be supporting this? And then, of course, giving them internet access as well with your tax dollars. I'm sure that there are plenty of people in the United States who don't have internet access that would love to have it, but no, we're giving it to the imams in Egypt instead. So I'm sure everyone's thrilled about that, and I think that Carl is right that in the 3 minutes of this news story, I watched it on video, 3 minutes basically encapsulates everything that's wrong with the world. Here we are spending money we don't have to support the enemy ideology. And just if you want some confirmation of that, what do you think that they are using this internet access for in Egypt? I'm going to use a webinar function. I'm not typically doing this as a webinar so that I can show you things visually, but I'm going to actually show you a picture right now if I can. Okay, Let me show my screen. Can everyone see this picture that I have here? Someone type yes if you can see a beautiful brochure cover. Yes. And this was received by a faculty member in an American university within the last week. I saw this in person. I actually took the picture that you're seeing here. It asks on the cover, as you can see, are you searching for happiness and success, safety and security within your inner self? Do you want to know why we were created, etc.? This is, in this brochure, a message of love to all seekers of truth. And it's actually a multi-page brochure. And on the inside, there's a lot of the typical things. So, for instance, they say, we invite you to accept the truth, to worship the Lord of Adam, Noah, Abraham, Moses, Jesus, and Muhammad. May peace be upon them. Turn to God alone in your prayers, supplications, fear, hope, and love, and for everything that you need. Beautiful, right? Of course, there's the usual self-contradictory stuff whenever you get a religious message. On the one hand, the brochure urges you to save yourself from hellfire by worshiping God alone, etc., etc. And then on the other hand, it says there is no compulsion in religion. It talks about the beauty of the Holy Quran, and among other things, it says that indeed the Holy Quran contains many scientific facts unknown at its revelation 1400 years ago, all of which have been proven correct. Another beautiful thing that it says about Islam and its prophet, or any prophet for that matter. Of course, you know, Islam, they believe that all of the other religious prophets really were prophets for Allah. They were just deluded if they thought that they were prophets for any other god except Allah. So they will include, you know, Jesus and Moses and Abraham and all of these, all the prophets for Allah. One thing that they said is no prophet or messenger ever committed sins, nor did he violate the sacredness of Allah. I'm hoping to get a little bit of input about whether that's true in a moment. Another thing that the brochure tells us is that Islam prohibits racism. All human beings are ultimately equal, and preference, if any, is by piety. And it says Islam prohibits all evil deeds, murder, adultery, theft, intoxication, lying, witchcraft, and terrorism. Very nice to know this, right? Now, in the mailing with this brochure, which came from Egypt, it says, there's a little flyer, and it says, how we found you. And it says, we obtained your name and address from the internet. So probably our tax dollars paid for an imam and his followers to sit at a computer, dig up the names and the addresses of faculty members in U.S. colleges, and resulted in them sending out these beautiful brochures so that they can convert us all to Islam. Now, I was going to see if Bosch in particular, because he knows so much about Islam, had anything to add or comment or question about the content of this brochure here. Let me see if I can find, Bosch says he volunteers. Let me unmute you. Yeah, Bosch.
You can hear me?
I can hear you.
No, it's so ludicrous that I know what to say.
Well, start with any individual assertion that I gave you there.
When they say, it forbids murder, not true. It forbids lying, not true. It's, takiyah, you can lie within Islam, you can kill infidels, you can kill, Muslims who are insufficiently Islamic. I mean, it's pretty incredible. I really don't know what else to add besides, it's just absolute lies.
Now someone's asking, do they heed the Ten Commandments in Islam?
I don't think they know. Well, literally they don't. Thou shalt not kill. They killed that. Yeah.
And in addition, what about this idea that none of the prophets have ever sinned?
I mean, yeah. What's a sin according to Islam? I guess being, doing something that Muhammad didn't do, and he killed, he lied, he cheated, he raped, he stole, I mean, it's just, it's unbelievable.
Right. This, you know, the story that he married a girl at six and then had sex with her when she was 9 years old. Right.
And that's, you know, that's the Ayatollah from Iran actually made the, I guess, illegal for 9-year-olds to get married, 9-year-old girls, in honor of Muhammad. Marrying Aisha when she was 9, having sex with him when she was, marrying him when she was 6, having sex with him when she was 9. I remember this one Muslim telling me that, well, it was just at one time. So, you know, it's like if you kill someone, well, I just killed one person. I'm not really a murderer. I just, you know. Anyway, I think I'll get off now if you need, you know.
I've got someone else who wants to make a quick comment. I'm going to mute you. And I've got Steve. Steve B., you can speak if you like. Are you there? I can't hear Steve. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and mute, and I'm going to continue on a little bit. So here they are trying to convert faculty members of the United States, promising them all of these wonderful things with this religion. And, you know, what are they in for? So I've got this story from the Washington Post just the other day talking about the Islamist rulers in Gaza, you know, they're from Hamas, and what they have been doing to the secular community, to those people who don't necessarily adhere to their interpretation of Islam or, you know, or who maybe just don't even believe in the religion at all. What do they do? It says Hamas has bullied men and women to dress modestly. It has tried to keep the sexes from mingling in public and sparked a flight of secular university students and educated professionals from the area. Most recently, it has confiscated novels it deems offensive to Islam from a bookshop, and it's banned Gaza's handful of male hairdressers from styling women's hair. Now, some people are arguing that this case of what's going on in Gaza could be a warning sign for those people who are pushing for a quick democratic reform elsewhere in the region. Why? Because Hamas itself rose to power in part by winning internationally backed parliamentary elections held in 2006. They were elected democratically. So, interesting in terms of, you know, if these people get their way, what is it that we have in store for us? I've got a question here from Daniel. Let me see. He says, is there a barrier between Sunni and Shiites in this regard? And I'm not so familiar with this. In what regard are you speaking, Daniel? Maybe I should see if I can get you to talk with us and let us know. So Daniel,
can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you now.
Okay, so as far as I'm aware, Hamas and Palestine and Iran, they are of the Shiite sect of Islam, whereas Saudi Arabia, Egypt, I guess parts of Tunisia and Libya, etc., they're of the Sunni sect of Islam. So I wonder if there's a barrier there. But also, I read in the news very recently that the Ayatollah in Iran held a conference between Sunni and Shiite leaders saying that the West, and specifically America, is trying to tear them apart from one another, and that what they have to do is unite together to drive the West out of the region. But that might not necessarily speak for the people in Egypt. So I was wondering if there's like some divide between the Sunnis and the Shiites, at least in regards to how Hamas would factor into Egyptian politics.
So you're saying that it would be maybe less oppressive if you were under one sect versus another?
Oh, no, not at all, not at all. It's just like, I mean, this is not a perfect example, but it'd be like communists versus fascists. In this case, it'd be like I don't know, Mao Zedong communists versus Stalin communists. I mean, they're both going to oppress you, mm-hmm. but like the Chinese and the Russians, from my knowledge, fought against each other for a certain period of time or were not allies. So just like with the Sunnis and the Shiites, I guess another example would be the Catholics and the Protestants. You know, they had their bouts from time to time. So I was wondering if that, you know, if there's any sort of bad blood between them currently that would maybe stop Hamas from factoring into Egyptian politics. And, you know,
Yeah, I don't know that Hamas itself is necessarily trying to factor into Egyptian politics, but people are taking what's going on in Hamas-ruled Gaza as a sign of what could happen in some of these other countries if they say, oh, let's have a democracy, let's vote in something like a Hamas, whatever the equivalent of Hamas is in, you know, for their region.
Right, the Muslim Brotherhood or whatever.
Sure, sure. In terms of putting up some sort of united front. I mean, you've got, you know, Iran reaching out to the people of Libya, you know, Ahmadinejad making his comment about the fact that Gaddafi firing on his citizens is grotesque, you know, et cetera. I think he's trying to sort of take a leadership role. I mean, we've always seen him sort of grandstanding and acting like he's going to take a leadership role in the Muslim world, and it seems like he's definitely trying to do that. And I've got some more to say about him in this material on the Mideast in general, so we'll get into that here in a second as well. Anything else?
Thank you.
Okay.
No, that's all for now.
Okay. Let's see. Okay, so let me get into some of this. So then the question is, so what's going on everywhere? I mean, it's so hard to even keep track of what's going on in the Middle East. Luckily, Fox News had a big rundown of what's going on in all the different countries. But first of all, we've got a story that says that Mubarak's fall in Egypt has sparked a rise of Islamists in politics, and they talk about the rise of the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood apparently was so popular in the past that it was even able to win 20% of the seats in the legislature, even though the Mubarak regime was using violence and fraud to swing the vote in favor of the other party. So I think there's a pretty significant chance that they can grab some control. One thing that I noted in this story, which I think is so true, is that, you know, the appeal of the Islamists is because of the fact that the country's poor, the people who are poor in those countries, have found refuge in their faith because they're struggling with the social inequities of daily life or just poverty, right? They think our life here is miserable, but at least we have the beyond this life to look forward to. And so religion, if it ends up being institutionalized more in these countries, can have an even larger staying power, you know, because it doesn't count on promising material success in this life. This is something that Leonard Peikoff has said time and again, that a religious, you know, theocracy poses a lot more danger because it's a theocracy, it's a totalitarian form of government that is going to have a lot more staying power. It doesn't have its citizens looking to their present living conditions as a measure of the success of the government. It doesn't promise anything here, it promises things in the beyond. So people are realizing that the Islamists, as they call them, you know, the consistent practitioners of this religion, that they have a good chance of getting some leadership positions in, you know, in these countries. Now, in terms of what's going on elsewhere, Libya, of course, is in the midst of what is turning out to be a civil war. You've got Gaddafi, basically in the east, as I understand it. Actually, he could be in the west. I'm sorry, I'm not good on my geography. You've got east versus west in Libya, and you've got Gaddafi basically in Tripoli, whichever side of the country is Tripoli, and he's giving speeches, and he is basically urging all of the citizens to go ahead and fight against the rebels, against the Revolutionary Party, and of course, assuming that they support him and they love him. That doesn't apparently seem to be the case, though. From what I understand, the rebels are making great inroads, and I think they've taken a town that's about 30 miles from Tripoli, so it's very unstable there. You may end up seeing Gaddafi get out of there. I watched some clips with John Bolton speaking about what's going on in Libya. Had a couple of interesting things to say. One, that we basically did, you know, and the Obama administration did renege on its responsibility to protect American citizens in Libya. They did not get the Americans out as quickly and safely as they should. And, you know, he kept saying, well, I think most of them are out that now. I'm afraid maybe some of them are perhaps still stranded at an airport there. And, you know, both he and Tucker Carlson, who was interviewing him, said, well, look, what we have been showing are these signs of weakness. We're sending signals of weakness everywhere. What have we done in terms of Libya? All we've said is that we are in the process of coordinating sanctions with other countries. Of course, we wouldn't dare take any unilateral action against Libya, and certainly nothing any more than sanctions. So that's all that we're doing. United Kingdom has frozen Gaddafi's assets in the banks there. That's what we know. But otherwise, as far as we know, there's really nothing going on. We maybe got our Americans out. Maybe there's still some that are there. Daniel is saying that so have the Swiss. The Swiss have also frozen the assets. And apparently there have been a large number of defections in Gaddafi's own administration. Yeah, I'm not surprised. From what I understand, Gaddafi's under this delusion, or he's trying to put it over on the people, that there's still a lot of support for him, but it doesn't seem like there is. So it looks like he's going to be ousted physically fairly soon, and then we might be in for some sort of a democracy, who knows. But the message from Carlson and agreed to by Bolton, and Bolton actually was emphasizing this point. He said, we are too afraid of offending people. What do? All we do is we go to the UN. We look at sanctions and things like this. Another story that they talked about, and it's Tucker Carlson who's really on this story, really trying to spread it out there, and I hadn't seen it yet. In Pakistan, apparently, there was an employee of the U.S. Embassy, or he may have been a CIA employee, and he was robbed. Apparently, he carried a firearm, so he actually shot his attackers while he was being robbed. And for this, he was jailed. And apparently, we haven't done anything to get this guy out of the country. Not a single thing. And Tucker Carlson, who I believe was maybe filling in for Hannity or somebody, I'm not sure, but he's been trying to do everything he can to get this story out. Just more proof that we are doing nothing with respect to the Middle East. We are just sending out this sign that we're weak. You know, as Leonard Peikoff has said a million times, we're just a paper tiger. That's what the U.S. is in these situations. So Egypt looks like it could turn towards something like the Muslim Brotherhood that's going to institute an Islamic theocracy. Libya, we don't really know. I haven't looked up the Pew Research polls in terms of what you would elect democratically in Libya, but I assume it would be similar. And then we've also got Iran. Iran did something very provocative this week. They went ahead and decided to dispatch warships to the Mediterranean via the Suez Canal, and they announced that they are seeking closer naval ties with Syria. Very, very classic style of Iran in the message that they sent out to talk about what they meant by sending these warships through the Suez Canal. They said they meant it as a, quote, message of peace, right, for all Muslim nations, end quote. So it's a message of peace if you're Muslim. As long as you're a good Muslim nation, then it's a message of peace. For everyone else, so who knows? Question is, what has the reaction been? All I've heard from Netanyahu, who we would always try to hope would be stronger, is that he viewed the move with gravity. And I think that statement was made before it ever happened. And I don't believe that he's made a statement since then. Iran, for all of its talking about the fact that they condemn Gaddafi for firing on the citizens, etc., what have they done? I just saw a story today that two of the main Iranian opposition leaders and their families have been abducted and put under house arrest. So that's always beautiful. And Ahmadinejad is also kind of sticking his neck out there, and giving messages not only to Middle East countries in the region, but to the entire world. He's saying now that he says that he's certain that the wave of unrest in the Middle East is going to spread to Europe and North America, and it's going to bring an end to the governments that he believes are oppressing and humiliating people. Of course, our government is oppressing and humiliating us. Actually, we sort of believe that, but we believe it for different reasons than he does, I can be sure. Now, let's see. I've got a few comments here. Daniel asks, do you believe the United States should take military action against Gaddafi and support the revolutionaries? No, not necessarily. I wouldn't say that. I would have to know more about the revolutionaries and what their actual cause is. There was one reporter had said that he'd gone to a hospital to visit one of the revolutionaries, and that the revolutionary said he'd been shot once through the abdomen, and he said he was willing to take 100 shots if it meant freedom for his people. Now, what does he mean by freedom? Does it mean freedom to build the ideal Islamic theocracy? We would definitely have to know more. No, I mean, and obviously military intervention is not always appropriate in these places where you don't think they necessarily pose any immediate threat to us. So whereas Iran, supposedly on the verge of getting nuclear weapons, it's not good for, you know, an Islamic leader like Ahmadinejad to be in Iran. We might want to support revolutionaries there. Libya, I'm not so sure what danger they would pose to us. Sanctions might be the only thing. And then the only thing I would have against what the U.S. is doing now is the fact that we have to, of course, coordinate our sanctions with other countries and ask the U.N. for permission and, you know, try not to offend anyone, etc. Another thing that I heard is that Obama has been on the record now, both as supporting Gaddafi and saying he's an okay guy, and I guess there's pictures with him shaking hands. Bosch was telling me about this the other day. Gaddafi's an okay guy, and then at the same time now he's on record saying Gaddafi should get out, and that all Obama's doing is covering his bases. And Bolton's big message, which I think is good, is that United States doesn't have any foreign policy at all. Maybe under Bush we had a weak foreign policy, but now we just have nothing at all, and we're not even doing our job in getting our citizens out of dangerous situations like that. And I do think this story of the man stranded in Pakistan is insane. Why wouldn't we do anything to get him out? He was being robbed. He didn't do anything wrong. He had a right to defend himself. He's supposed to have diplomatic immunity over there if he's an employee of the U.S. Embassy, so he shouldn't be in jail. He should be out. The only good news is that I heard that the Iranian nuclear program suffered a setback this week. So in terms of Iran, there's your good news there. So we talked about Libya. In Tunisia, you had the resignation of the prime minister, and then I guess the president appointed a new prime minister. Not exactly sure what is going to come of that. In Bahrain, you had protesters who streamed through the diplomatic area and other places chanting against the country's king, etc. All these processions that have paralyzed the capital, etc. So we've got some unrest there. We already talked about Egypt. And in Oman now, you've got security forces firing tear gas and rubber bullets at protesters who are demanding political reforms there. In Yemen, there's going to be protesters, and a lot of the opposition parties are going to join these young protesters in their push to bring down the president as well. In Iraq, there's been a lot of anti-government protests, so we've helped this new government be set up. It was supposed to be so good, but there's been a lot of anti-government protests there. And now the prime minister has given the ministers 100 days to improve the performance, otherwise they might be fired. And then finally, this is the thing that struck me as kind of funny. You've got Saudi Arabia, right? So all these other countries, you've got protests, people taking to the streets, opposition parties, rebels, violence, right? This is what's going on in Saudi Arabia. says more than 100 leading Saudi academics and activists have called on the king to enact sweeping reforms, and they want him to set up a constitutional monarchy. And they've got an internet statement, and they're saying that Saudi Arabia is rife with nepotism and corruption, etc. So in Saudi Arabia, you've got this relatively civilized call for reform, at least for now. And perhaps it's because a lot of people from Saudi Arabia come and get educated here, and they decided maybe we should put out a written conceptual statement of what we want first before we just take to the streets and start yelling freedom and all the other wonderful things that they yell, such as down with Israel and all that. I want to see if anybody had something to chime in on here. Put your hand up on the screen if you'd like. Okay, I still have Steve. I'm going to try Steve again. Steve. Steve B., you've got your hand raised. Can you speak? Okay, I can't hear Steve. So it could be that, Steve, if you did try to speak and I couldn't hear you, it could be that the little doc software, you have to tell the audio what your input is. And if you've got a headset hooked up, it may not be automatically registering your headset and the microphone as the source of the audio. I've seen that happen in the past with some people. Okay, so then the question is, what are we doing insofar as we're involved over there? Of course, we've been in Afghanistan as part of the NATO forces in Afghanistan. They're supposedly trying to fight any of the so-called radical Islamists, right? Any of the Taliban, any of the jihadists that are in Afghanistan. And what's the latest story? Latest story is that a NATO assault killed, who did they kill? They killed 65 civilians. That's what we're concerned about in Afghanistan this week, that our assault killed 65 civilians. Now, why do you think it is that our assault killed 65 civilians? I can assure you from everything I know about military policy that it was either a mistake or it was because you've got very savvy jihadists over there who are using civilians as human shields to avoid getting killed themselves. There's no doubt about it. But, you know, what do we emphasize in the news stories? You know, we're so bad because we killed 65 civilians while we're trying to get rid of all of these people over there. So that is the Middle East in a nutshell, and I can give you one picture postcard of what it's meaning for us. And this is something also that Bolton was emphasizing, because I really think, I mean, there's really two fallouts that come for us from this. One is, are you going to get an Islamist regime over there, you know, an Islamic theocracy that is going to pose a danger to us because it has access to some sort of biological or nuclear weapons? That's one problem, so the safety issue. And then the second problem is an economic problem, and of course we've dug our own hole with respect to this. It's the oil issue. I went to fill up, you know, tank of gas the other day, and yes, my car has to take premium, so I have to buy the most expensive gas, and yes, I'm in California, which means that there's an extra quarter per tank, or per gallon, excuse me, an extra quarter per gallon that people in neighboring states do not have to pay. Nonetheless, it was $3.96 per gallon for me to buy gas this week, and they're looking at gas. It's going to be well over $4 this summer, and that's just what they're predicting now, not even knowing what's going to happen in the Middle East in the future. So this could be a big mess for us in terms of our economy as well, and of course, insofar as our economy gets worse and worse, then it's going to redound on the safety issue, because we're not going to be able to defend ourselves as well because you don't have as much funding for the military. So this is really bad news. I have, it could also give us impetus to drill home, says Ryan. And it does, it is starting to have some support here. I have seen some stories where congressmen are saying, look, why don't we go ahead and drill here at home? Can't we just go ahead and do that now? And I think that's great. Let's go ahead and do it, because, I mean, the sooner the better. But as far as I understand, there's a pretty big lag time from the time that somebody gets permission to go ahead and start drilling and the time that we actually see oil and then refined oil into gasoline from those efforts. So I'm not sure exactly what the lag time is. I mean, you know, I've seen people write a book and get it out within a week if the topic is hot, you know, Justin Bieber biography or something, right? So people can do things quickly if they're motivated. But I do think it takes a long time to set up the infrastructure required to, you know, do this drilling. And even though they give permission, it doesn't mean that they're going to make it super easy in terms of all the heaps of regulations that they put on the oil drilling. And I'm sure there's even more regulations ever since the BP spill in the Gulf. So yeah, I think that would obviously be a good way to go. Any comments anyone want to chime in on the Middle East? I've got no hands raised. Okay, well then, if with your permission, I will continue to my next topic. And here's the thing, with all this mess in the Middle East, with our economy, we talked about the budget last week and how silly the Republicans were behaving. You know, they couldn't even get enough votes together to cut $100 billion. I made that mistake last week as well. $100 billion out of a budget of $3.7 trillion. They can't even do that. All they can get is $61 billion. And now, what their new proposal is going to be, I'm not even sure if it's going to be even $61 billion. So it looks pretty bleak out there right now. That's really kind of what I'm saying. And the question is, do we have any hope for the future politically? And we're looking, of course, towards 2012. Right now, we do have a majority in the House, but with a majority in the House alone, it's not going to get us very far. Yes, the House managed to go ahead and vote for this $61 billion in cuts, but they couldn't even get the Senate to go ahead and, couldn't even get the Senate to go ahead and vote on that at all. And, of course, even if the Senate did vote on it, Obama's going to veto it because he is very married to his $3.7 trillion, and he's very proud of the fact that he's going to cut, I think, $1.1 trillion over 10 years or some nonsense, which never happens because 10 years, he's not even around to see the fallout of all the stuff that he did. Typical politicians. So what's our hope? Well, we've seen in the past the CPAC Republican straw poll. Ron Paul got 30% and actually won there. Ron Paul is probably a disaster in terms of domestic policy too, but the thing that always gets me about him is foreign policy. And all we need is somebody who's an isolationist in foreign policy, who is not willing to intervene in the Middle East when necessary, because it may indeed be necessary if Iran's going to continue to do these provocative things, sending their warships out there, et cetera, if they ever get their act together with regard to their nuclear, which hopefully they won't. Now, Mitt Romney, I mean, he's the one who started the Romney Care, as they call it, in Massachusetts, so he's hopeless. But he won second in the straw poll, 23%. Then you've got Gary Johnson, who I'm not so familiar with. You've got Chris Christie, who at first I thought was good, but then I've heard some things about him since that makes me not so excited. And then Newt Gingrich got 5% in the Republican straw poll. And I saw a story today that Newt Gingrich is trying to reconnect with the American people. That was a story that I saw today. One thing I will just give you a snapshot on Newt Gingrich. There was a big headline on Drudge the other day. It said, Newt Gingrich warns Obama of impeachment. And you think, okay, great. You know, there's all kinds of things that we're upset about, you know, with Obama. You know, maybe the way that he passed the health care bill, it was slimy backdoor deals and all kinds of crazy procedural things that they put into it, so they can't even apparently defund it. All this horrible stuff. You know, certainly we could find all sorts of impeachable offenses, right? So what is Newt Gingrich's problem with Obama, and what's the reason he thinks that Obama should be impeached? He thinks Obama should be impeached because Obama has failed to enforce legislation that protects marriage. So there was the Marriage and Family Act that, apparently a marriage is between a man and a woman and this and that. And Newt Gingrich wants this to be enforced by Obama, and he's very upset. So the only reason that Newt is mad at Obama is because of some social conservative issue. Perfectly hopeless, in addition. Now, I got a question. How much of this social conservatism is just posturing to get the Iowa vote, says Ryan. I agree. That may indeed be what he's doing, and I believe that. I don't think you were here last week, Ryan, but I told a story. Newt Gingrich, as far as I can tell, he tries to tell everybody what he thinks they want to hear at different times. He just is striking me as your typical politician trying to get votes, avoiding saying anything super controversial. But again, if he's trying to go to Hawaii, that'd be great. Let's go. If he's trying to go to Iowa, I would definitely see that. I wouldn't doubt that at all. Now, in terms of Ron Paul being a domestic disaster, he may not. Now, I did hear that he was an opponent of abortion, and maybe someone can tell me if I was correct on that. Type in yes or no. Yeah, that's correct. So that would be a big problem if he starts going out pushing out those social issues as well. Let me talk about somebody else who was on the poll, Michelle Bachmann. If I got my Congresswoman correctly, I saw on video this week basically Michelle Bachmann trying to urge that they go ahead and amend some budget legislation to defund Planned Parenthood. And the speech was so ridiculous. Basically, she was saying that women, because of Planned Parenthood sometimes locates itself in strip malls or something, that it's kind of near other things. So she says, well, what do women do? They go grocery shopping, they get their lattes, and they go get an abortion. And it was just so stupid. And to think, okay, why not, if you're trying to unite people behind smaller government, suppose it is your desire to defund Planned Parenthood because you don't want government paying for people's abortions. Okay, fine. But why not just say, we don't want government paying for health care? And this is one aspect of health care. So I just thought she was silly. Now, I've heard people compliment her and say that she's very good, but I'm very scared about her in terms of the social issues. So in terms of the Republican straw poll, I was not very encouraged at all. However, there was this past weekend a Tea Party summit, and maybe many of you are familiar with this. They showed some videos from it. Jerome Brooke from the Ayn Rand Institute spoke at the Tea Party summit this weekend. It was in Phoenix, and they conducted a live straw poll on site there. Now, it turns out they conducted an internet poll, and the internet poll was flooded with Ron Paul fans, and he ended up winning the internet straw poll. But in terms of the live straw poll of people who actually went to Phoenix and attended the summit, Herman Cain, whom I hadn't heard of, I am embarrassed to say, Herman Cain had actually got 2% of the straw poll in, at the CPAC. He got 22% and actually won the Tea Party Summit straw poll in Phoenix. And the second place was 16%, Tim Pawlenty. Third place with 15% was Ron Paul. Then you've got 10% for Sarah Palin, which is not surprising given that she was been heavily involved from the Tea Party, with the Tea Party all along. And then you've got Mitt Romney at 6%. But I want to talk a little bit about Herman Cain. I went ahead and looked on his exploratory website and tried to read some things about him. And I started to get a little bit nervous at the beginning because I was looking at his biography, and he describes his parents, and they said, well, they had their faith in God, and so that things, were going to be okay. And I said, okay, he brought his faith in God into play in the very first paragraph. But then I looked at both the rest of his biography and a lot of his materials there, and the rest actually looked okay. I can't tell, of course, how much he would actually bring conservative social issues into it, but the emphasis of all the materials on his website has to do with his business background, has to do with his providing strong leadership, has to do with giving people advice on how to achieve success in their own lives, success and happiness in their own lives. I saw very little mention of God. I don't think I saw anything else. I don't think I saw the word except for in the first paragraph of that biography. So overall, I was actually pretty impressed with him. They have a little part of the website now where they're going to have him periodically put little position papers out on different things. And the one and only one that I saw there was from the 21st of February, and it was in support of Governor Walker in Wisconsin. And it was a good piece, a good position statement there. So Herman Cain might actually be a positive option for us there in the future. Then I've got a dog barking there in the background, people. You got to hear a little bit of extra noise. Then we've got Tim Pawlenty. He's the former governor of Minnesota. And I also thought he looked good. He, spoke about freedom. He spoke about the federal bureaucracy crippling progress and keeping us from doing the things that we want in our lives. I didn't see any mention of social issues on his website either. So both of those candidates seemed, pretty much okay to me. But again, until they're actually out there and they're asked their positions on these various things, we don't know. I was disappointed, of course, that you wouldn't have John Bolton listed in these straw polls. Last week I mentioned the joke that people say, well, he's got facial hair, so they can't have him. I think Herman Cain might have a little bit of facial hair, too. I hope that doesn't hold someone good back. But I do think that Bolton is positioning himself to be a Secretary of State nominee. And obviously, if we have somebody who's a good, strong president, Bolton would be great to have as a Secretary of State, so that wouldn't be so bad either. Do these Tea Party candidates, as opposed to the Republican business-as-usual politicians, do they have a better chance? Maybe. Maybe. I mean, way back when the Tea Party first started, it started because of Rick Santelli on, a business program suggesting that Chicago should have a Tea Party out, in the lake there. And it was just a very humble beginning for this whole thing that actually became a Tea Party. And it's just grown and grown. So, it's too soon to know, but I would say given the trajectory of the Tea Party from its inception during that show with Santelli all the way to now, I think there's no reason to think that you couldn't get, a Herman Cain or a Tim Pawlenty or any of these candidates that seem pretty good in there. The question is, will they disappoint us like so many of these guys have? Anybody out there have any impressions of Cain or Pawlenty? I've got Mark Wallace says that, yeah, Cain was pictured with a mustache in the March issue of the Atlantic magazine. Last week I talked about this. The people had said that Bolton, never since he grew the mustache naturally as a kid, whenever it starts growing when you're a teenager, never has he shaved it. Now, Cain, maybe he's not so attached to his mustache, so he could sacrifice it for the good of the nation or such. Now, one listener is saying that he met Gary Johnson yesterday, and he might possibly have the best ideas, but he unfortunately doesn't have a very presidential presence, and he's trying to work on that by going around the country and talking to small groups. He did, in the Republican straw poll, get 6%, but again, you never know what could happen between now and the time that, it's actually time for the primaries, etc. But it would be interesting if we actually have a Tea Party candidate and we get rid of this whole two-party system, which basically has been almost like having one party because the Republicans and the Democrats have been virtually indistinguishable at times. Cain, apparently, I'm hearing, wants to return to the gold standard. That's about as strong as I've heard it from anybody. And Mark Wallace also says that Cain appears as charming and gives some example. Oh, he refers to himself as the dark horse candidate. And that's funny. I said I knew nothing about him. I did go to his site, and yes, he's black. But he apparently was a very successful business executive from Godfather's Pizza, turned it around, and has all sorts of success literature that you can go out there and devour. And I like that entrepreneurial angle, and especially if that's what he's going to emphasize, if he's going to emphasize business success and the economic angle and try to stay away from the other issues, that would be wonderful. Now, let me talk about other reasons perhaps to be optimistic in politics. But I do actually have one hand raised that I'm going to go ahead and unmute. Pooja, are you there?
Hi, yeah, this is Pooja.
Uh-huh.
I'm from Minnesota, and I have never heard anything from Tim Pawlenty that I have not liked. So I've been talking to my objectivist friends here, and finding out, if there's something in his history that, is kind of bad. And most of them point out that one of the reasons I don't see anything bad from him is because he's such an opportunistic. And I believe a few years back, he was very much taken in by, the environmentalist group and ideology. And then very soon he realized that that's not very popular here. So he kind of, gave that up.
So you see him as sort of a politician who's going whatever way the wind blows? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, yes. Mm. And also he's an evangelist Christian.
Okay.
He doesn't really believe in the separation of church and state. So that's another thing, So two things, the environmental, yeah.
Well, that's disappointing. So maybe Cain is the one that we want to learn more about as time goes on. And all I could say, if we could just find one strong, decent candidate, one of the reasons that I do like Bolton is that Bolton did seem okay with putting social issues aside, and he was definitely in favor of free markets. Individual liberty is something that he talks about, and of course very knowledgeable about foreign policy. And today particularly, we have got to have a president who is strong on foreign policy. One of the reasons that we may be having all this unrest in the Middle East right now is that they all realize that we've got just basically an empty chair in the White House, nobody doing anything. And it's the ideal time for them to go ahead and stir things up without much in the way of consequences at all. We won't dare act on our own. And, again, I agree with Tucker Carlson. This sign that we're sending people by not even fighting for someone who has diplomatic immunity in Pakistan to be released from prison, we're just letting him languish over there. We are sending weak signals everywhere. Now, we've got just a few more minutes, so let me talk about some reasons that I think we might have optimism about the future. We had Yaron Brook at the Tea Party Summit, as I said, and he gave a few talks. One was actually I don't know if you would call it a keynote. I don't think they call it a keynote, but he was giving what you would call a general session lecture at the Tea Party Summit, and it was on opening night. So whereas they did have an opening ceremony, when I looked at the schedule, I saw Yaron as the first official speaker on that opening night. All I can say is it's a pity for everybody else who had to follow him that he was the first, because nobody could follow Yaron. If anybody saw it online, if you haven't seen it online, I encourage you to go look it up and watch. It's a 15-minute speech. I was really amazed at how beautifully he fit all of the essential points into that 15-minute speech. It was rousing. He said, look, we're the Tea Party. Do we have a right to that name? What was the Tea Party as it was originally instituted? What did it consist of? They didn't just say, please reduce our taxes a little bit, please give us a little bit of liberty, etc. That they actually stood for the principle of individual rights, and they said, give me liberty or give me death. And he's saying, is the Tea Party in favor of this? And he brought up some very controversial things about, putting entitlements on the table, that they have to be willing to start phasing these out. He you know, said the word that these basically are immoral schemes and they have to be cut. And he really set the tone, I think, for the rest of it. There was a subsequent CNN article where they talked about a congressman. I think it was a congressman from Texas, maybe Barton, who got up and was talking, and the audience was booing him because he wasn't talking about making big enough cuts. And then only when he mentioned that maybe they were willing to put entitlements on the table in terms of what they call reform, they wouldn't dare talk about cutting these things. Then maybe the audience, you know, the audience calmed down and they were willing. But I think, you know, Yaron set the tone and said, look, if we're really going to be serious about this, we have to cut. And we have to realize that, you know, each individual owns his own life, that it's immoral to say that you're going to take money from one person and pay for the health care of another, you know, et cetera, that Social Security punishes those people who would have saved it and gotten a lot higher rate of return, and it rewards those people who would, you know, have spent every money, you know, every bit of money that they had and never set anything aside for retirement, et cetera. And I thought it was excellent. Apparently, he got a standing ovation of 1,800 people. And then he had a couple of breakout sessions on Saturday, and I understand that in each of them he had over 100 people, and he got about a two-thirds standing ovation in each of those, and he got the impression that a number of people in the audience didn't necessarily like him so much. And why is it? Because Yaron is uncompromising in his message, whereas a lot of the Tea Party, they don't really realize what it would mean to cut the government and do it properly, that you have to basically stand on principle. Otherwise, if you say, oh, well, we just want to cut a little bit, you know, by what standard do you decide what gets cut and what doesn't get cut? And pretty soon, you know, maybe you've made some drastic cuts under a particular president, and without any principle instituted as to why you've made these cuts, next president comes in, he's got some pet projects or pet programs, and it creeps back again, and you're spending the same money as before. So in any event, Yaron, I think when he gives his uncompromising message, I believe that people in the audience, some of them are happy about it, but some of them, when they realize what it's going to be required, what you actually have to stand up for on principle, they don't necessarily like him so much, because I think they have still some of the liberal-leaning altruism in them. But I still overall think the positive reaction is a good sign, and there's still a long way to go in terms of influencing the outcome of the next election. If someone like a Kane is listening to someone like Yaron Brook in formulating his message to the people, it could go a long way to making this country a lot better. Now, I don't know if I've got any comments on that one, but if not, I want to go ahead and go on to another topic. I was hoping this would actually be a bit of good news, but now I'm starting to hear it's not going to be such good news. When we talk about hope for the future, one of the things that we would hope for is that culturally, the culture would get better. And one of the things that was going to be released into the culture very soon, and we would hope to have some influence, is the Atlas Shrugged movie. As many of you know, they are going to release Atlas Shrugged Part 1 on April 15th. They say it's going to be released to a wide audience, but I don't think it's yet clear exactly how many cities the movie is going to be showing in. And the other night, I believe it was Thursday night, several people were invited to Los Angeles to go ahead and screen the movie, and in hopes, of course, that they would give reviews. And there was a positive review published at Big Hollywood, but from people I respect, I've heard reviews that are not so good. I'm still waiting to hear some reviews from some other people, but Charles Weinkoff is someone who's a Facebook friend of mine, and he's actually a recent reader of Rand. This is what he says. He says, "The Atlas Shrugged movie confirms my worst fears." He says, "It's humorless, too literal, boring. The movie will not make anyone want to read the novel, and it reduces Rand's ideas to the most rudimentary basics, making them very easy to deride. He says it's a real shame that a major studio never tried to make another Fountainhead of her crowning achievement, end quote. Weinkauf loves Rand. As I said, he came to her work fairly recently. He's very enthusiastic. And in a way, I almost like his perspective better. I mean, again, I haven't seen the movie. I'll have to see the movie and give you my own thought, perhaps, although I'd hate to have the book ruined for me by watching a movie that's bad. So I haven't decided yet. But when you've got someone who is very newly enthusiastic about all of the great virtues of the book and somebody who appreciates art the way that Weinkauf does, it really resonated with me. You know, we had all watched the trailers and thought, okay, well, maybe it's not going to be too bad. There's some good stuff there. But my thought is that a lot of us are bringing our own enjoyment of Atlas Shrugged to our watching of the trailers, etc., and that we couldn't get anything out of those trailers if we hadn't brought our own enjoyment of the book to it. That's really what I'm afraid of. And of course, I'm afraid of the fact that people are going to watch this movie not having read Atlas Shrugged and then perhaps have the book spoiled for them for no good reason. So I don't want to end it on a down note, though, and I do have to end this show. So let me go ahead and end it on an up note. Bosch released his comic, The Infidel, this week, and so far he's gotten a very good reaction. Again, his comic is an anti-jihad comic. It's got very uncompromising ideas portrayed in the novel, very controversial, and he has gotten good reviews all over the place. Even from people who disagreed, they are very impressed with the artistry in it as well. So we're just starting to see the beginning of that, but that work may indeed end up having a positive influence on the culture. So there, I'll end it on some good news. And anything else before I go? I think I'm going to let you go. People have some good comments on Kane. Yeah, there may be some reasons to be hopeful for the future. And we'll be discussing these candidates weekly as these podcasts go on. So thank you very much, and everyone have a good night, and I hope to talk to you next week.